Hello and welcome to the Food Connections podcast, the podcast that connects you with the food you eat. I'm Dr. Laura Wyness, a registered nutritionist and one of Scotland's regional food tourism ambassadors. I'm interested in all things related to food and nutrition, and I love learning more about the food we eat, how it's made, and getting to know the people involved in making our food. This episode is all about oats. Alan Meikle is Managing Director of Hamlands of Scotland, Scotland's leading oat milling company. He's worked in the food and drinks industry for almost 40 years and has been at Hamlands of Scotland for the past 30 of those years. In the past, Alan was chairman of the trade body for British Oat and Barley Millers Association. Hamlands Mill is located along the Banffshire coast in the picturesque northeast of Scotland. It's also the perfect area for canoeing, surfing, walking, running and mountain biking, which Alan enjoys in his spare time. As someone who enjoys eating oats in lots of different ways, I was keen to find out more about how this Scottish food is grown, how it's processed, and if I can get some tips for making the perfect porridge, all the better. I hope you enjoy listening. So welcome to this episode of Food Connections. Today I'm joined by Alan Meikle, Managing Director of Hamlands of Scotland. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Good morning. Very well. Glorious summer's day. The harvest is upon us. It is. This must be our 1 week of summer, I suspect.
Well, make the most of it, I suppose. Could you first of all start by saying a little bit about the history of Hamlands, because it is a really well-known brand in Scotland and has quite a long history, I believe. So can you provide a little bit of a summary of how the business started and kind of how it's developed?
Yes, Hamlands has been around for over 100 years. It started, like many things, it was a local mill in a local village, producing local product for local people. But just like every industry, the number of players have reduced. What's been left has got bigger. We are based in Banff, northeast of Scotland. We started in the little village of Portsoy, which is literally 3 miles west of where I'm sitting just now. And we were the local mill. We were a local mill that took in grain from all the wee farmers round about, milled it, sold it locally, and that was that. And as things moved on, we got bigger and bigger, still within literally right in the centre of the village, and to the point where we were actually producing bulk product to go down to people like Sainsbury's, who were starting up supermarkets, were becoming the norm in those days. And so we came to an impasse, and that impasse was twofold. One was that the local family who had it had no one to pass it on to, so they needed to sell it to somebody. And their supplier of oats was a company called Northeastern Farmers, who were a farmers cooperative in the northeast of Scotland. So they bought it. And the second impasse came when they realised that as they were growing it, they had a problem. And the problem was that they were a local mill bang in the centre of the village. The mill was wood. Wooden food just did not go. So that was the first thing. Secondly, the lorries were getting bigger. They couldn't get the big lorries in. They couldn't get the big lorries out. And they were having a problem. So what they did was they built a brand new mill. And that mill was built in the late 80s, early 90s in a site 3 miles east of where they were. Why? Well, they had 100 years of experience in that mill. They had 100 years of people learning how to mill oats. They had 100 years of passing down all their expertise. So they wanted to keep it local. They could have gone west. They could have gone into what was in those days Highlands and Islands Enterprise area, which was sort of Elgin to Inverness. And they would have got huge amounts of grants. But they decided to stay here. They moved the mill 3 miles east and built a brand new mill. So in its day, it was the most modern mill in Western Europe, and it was located on a greenfield site at the end of the old World War II airfield at Boindy. And that's where we've been ever since.
Wow. Okay. So it's right in the very northeast tip, basically. How big is it? Can you paint the picture? How many staff have you got working there?
Well, I'll paint the picture in a number of different ways. In terms of size, it is a big building because mills tend to go up the way. Everything gets taken to the top of the mill and it drops through all the floors by gravity. So it goes from one machine to next, next thing gets taken back to the top. So we've got 5 layers in the mill on this site. It's a large blue building. If you're passing, you can't miss it. It's big enough that in the old days when the jets from RAF site near Elgin came along the coast, they would use it as target practice. And luckily they don't now. And the reason they don't is because we've got wind turbines round about us. that are supplying the energy to the mill as well as local people. And they used to come so low that I'd turn around in my office and I could see a jet fighter coming flying towards us, which was frightening. He made one mistake, we were going to be hit. And he was on his way to the bombing range slightly further east to us. That doesn't happen anymore, but it's a big site. It employs about 60 people. It works 24/7, 358 days a year, producing material, Scottish oats for our brand Hamlin's, as well as industrial customers to put them into things, as well as own label porridge oats.
So a very busy production site, basically.
Absolutely. 24 hours a day, we're continually bringing lorries in and taking lorries out.
Wow. Okay. And where do you fit into this? How did you first start working at Hamlin's, or what's your story?
I'm glad you're asking me that question, not the boys. Where do I fit? As managing director, we are a small business. So yes, we've got a lovely hierarchy and I'm right at the top of the tree in that respect. But it's in a day-to-day operation, we are very down to earth. We are very small in number. We produce a lot of product, so everybody's can talk from the top to the bottom. There is no hierarchical structure. You talk to whoever you need to get the job done. That's how it works. I've been here 30 years, just under 30 years, literally, I think about 6 months under 30 years. I joined it from other food businesses in the UK and I came north. Why did I come north? It was a good opportunity and I love canoeing, hill walking, skiing, etc. And this is God's country when it comes to things like that. So I came north to run the business and haven't left since.
So you probably know the mill inside out then?
I hope so.
And every job possible there?
Well, I hope so. And I hope I know all the ways that can... Well, we've put in a lot of kit over that period. So yes, I've put in all that kit. So I understand the systems. But sometimes you look at something and think, where does that go and what does that mean? But you eventually get that.
Yeah. And have you seen quite a few changes then over the years? And or how's the business changed?
Absolutely. We were bought over by a company called Morning Foods in 1997. And the reason who are slightly older and have long memories will remember 97 was foot and mouth and BSE. Mm-hmm. And our owners at that time were a company called Northeastern Farmers, who were, by their name, into farming in a big way. They really suffered, as did a lot of farmers. So what they did was they took the consultants' advice of that era, which was to retreat into core values. That was the consultants' advice. That's what businesses should do. 20 years ago, they had bought lots of other businesses because consultants had said, you need to get into added value. So they bought all these businesses, themselves included, and they got into added value. 20 years later, the consultant said, retreat into core values was the end thing. So they retreated into core values and sold all their other businesses that they had bought. We were one of them. So we were sold to Morning Foods, who are Europe's biggest oat milling company. They're based in England, but we are very much a standalone Scottish site that's allowed to run ourselves, which is great.
Brilliant. And I saw on your website, you've got a wind turbine as well.
Yes, we have.
When did that come in?
Well, with the new ownership, obviously, we went from, in the old days, we were working 12 hours a day, 5 days a week. We built up the business under our new ownership, so we now work 24/7. As part of that, we looked at our cost base, and that we came from a cost base. Obviously, the biggest cost in an oat milling business, firstly, is oat, secondly, is energy. We are blessed being based in the northeast of Scotland because it gives you great oats, but it also gives you huge winds and rains, etc. So the winds we can harness, and we have a number of acres around our site, so we harnessed it to put a wind turbine on. That wind turbine is a 2.3 megawatt wind turbine, and if you add up all the energy it produces in the year, it's about the same energy as we use in the year. So obviously some days it produces none and we have to buy from the grid, other days it produces far too much and we have to sell to the grid. But overall, it produces what we need in the year. So, yep, we have a wind turbine sitting right beside us.
Very, very sustainable.
Sustainable and economical.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And oats are a very versatile ingredient. So do you make lots of different products or is it just the kind of oats?
We are purely oats here. All we do, the whole site is based around oats. It's right. Hamlin's is an oat-based company. We don't have any wheat, barley, etc. on site. We make oats for both organic, gluten-free and standard products on this site. When we're doing gluten-free and organic, we obviously do it in totally different ways to standard. So with organic, so for instance, if I think of organic coming in, we'll clean everything down and we'll have organic intake days when nothing moves apart from organic. Similarly, when we're doing organic production, we clean everything down, we do organic production run, and that can take 2, 3, 5, 10 days, depends on how long we're working for, and then we come back out of it to start. When we're doing gluten-free, we do it in a completely different way. We buy our gluten-free oats from particular farmers who have regimes, etc., in place. We also then bring the oats from the farmers directly to our own oat storage, our own gluten-free oat storage, which is located just beside the mill. And we bring it in our own lorries and our own trailers. And these are only purely gluten-free trailers. Mm. So it then goes into our purely gluten-free store. And when we are making a gluten-free run, we obviously stock the place, clean it down, etc. But we also bring the gluten-free oats directly into the mill, missing out all the intake systems, the normal intake systems, storage systems, silos, elevators, conveyors, etc. So it comes directly into the mill through a special gluten-free intake point, and then we mill it out. Once we've then done that, we then test it twice internally and 2 times externally to make sure it passes the gluten-free protocol. Once it's passed that, we then put a big tick on it and we sell it as gluten-free. So we make gluten-free, organic, and standard. Obviously, most of our time is spent on standard, but we do the whole range of products from this site, but all oats, nothing but oats.
Yeah, but quite a rigorous process then, for especially for it the is. Gluten-free. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep, it has okay. to be.
Yeah, and oats are naturally gluten-free, but is it just because of the other crops maybe?
It is. If you are intolerant, then you have, it's a spectrum. So at one end, if you are to have a little bit of gluten, you might get a dicky tummy or something similar to that. But at the other end, you could potentially die. So we have to make sure that everything is absolutely 101% perfect. So when you're making gluten, yes, you're right. Oats are technically gluten-free, but there is potential ingress of things either in the field, storage, wherever else. So we have special machines that we put it through, special cleaning machines that we put it through, as well as our normal cleaning machines that are taking out any of the barleys, wheats, rye, etc., out of those products. And we're taking it down to the nth degree. So we want to make sure that what we put in a packet, we can put hand on heart and say it is correct, which is why we then test it at the end for 4 times to make sure that it is hand on heart and there's absolutely no problems.
Very, very reassuring.
But yeah, gluten-free is very much a special operation in itself, as well as yeah. going through its normal cleaning and processing operation.
So it sounds like you're dealing with a lot of oats, basically. Yeah. Where do all the oats come from?
Well, we are Scottish. That's what we process and that's what we sell. Mm-hmm. We bring our oats in from Scotland. If we were a small mill, we bring our oats locally from local farmers. But obviously, the bigger and bigger and bigger you get, the more and more oats you need. That becomes a problem. Problem two ways. If there is a problem with the harvest in a particular geographical area, then if that happens to be your local area, then obviously you're going to get a lot less oats. But secondly, Scotland has about 250,000 tons of oats, and we use a huge amount of that in this processing plant. So we've got to make sure that we have as much oats as we need and a bit more in case anything goes wrong. So we buy our oats from away north as far as Thurso and Wick, and we buy it away down in the south as far as the Scottish borders, etc. Now, obviously, we'd like to buy as much locally as possible, but we want to make sure that we have the volume of Scottish oats that we need to make sure, hand on heart, we put Scottish product out in the marketplace. If you've no product to mill, you've no product to sell.
And do oats... Well, obviously, they are synonymous with Scotland. They grow well in the Scottish climate, I take it.
They do, and they grow well in the northeast of Scotland, which is why okay. we're here. If you remember the conversation earlier, there was hundreds of oat mills. And then these reduced and the oat mills got bigger. And as we set up under northeastern farmers, when they moved here, they shut down 3 oat mills and brought them into here, this site here. And that was just part of that consolidation process. Now in Scotland, of any major size, there is 2 oat mills, and then there is another couple of a slightly smaller size. So that's the number of oat mills that are left. Mm. So you're dealing with a much bigger operation. Now, that operation obviously needs a lot more oats to survive. So we've got to make sure the oats are grown, and we've got to make sure those oats are grown to our specifications. Oats like 3 things. They like poor soil, so they grow better on poor soils, they're a scavenging crop. They like lots of daylight hours, and they like lots of water. Now, if you're sitting in the northeast of Scotland, we have all 3 of those things, the latter 2 in particular.
Yeah, in abundance.
So we grow very, very good oats.
Yeah.
And there are certain parts of Scotland, further north, et cetera, that you just physically can't grow wheat, barley, et cetera. So you will grow more and more oats. And especially as you go halfway up a hillside and the like. So, yes, this is a great part of the world for growing oats. We get very good quality oats from this part of the world. You can technically grow oats anywhere, but they are better suited to the type of soils and climate that we have up here. Mm-hmm. Hence, we're here.
And is there different varieties of oats that you get?
Loads of varieties of oats. There is two different types of oats, one of which is winter oats and one of which is spring. And that designation is given to when the oat is planted. So if you were to go way down the south of England and you were planting an oat, chances are you'd have your harvest from the previous crop done by July, early August. You would then get your fields ready and then the oats would be planted maybe August, maybe September. So they would be classed as winter oats. And you can plant winter oats all the way up until you get to a certain point in Scotland when winter oats become a problem. If you are in the north of Scotland, then obviously it's slightly different. Your other crops don't come out of the fields quite so early, so it's much later before you plant them. But secondly, you have what's called winter kill, which is if you start planting something late, just before the winter starts, they start to take hold, and then the winter comes along in terms of frost, etc., and kills them. So it doesn't actually survive. So you wouldn't plant them prior to the winter. You'd wait until the spring starts, and then you'd plant them in the springtime. Hence, they're called spring oats. So in general terms, the further north you go, the more spring oats, and the further south you go, the less spring oats. So spring oats and winter oats. And then within that, there's lots of different varieties. We as a miller don't tell the farmer what to grow. We have set our mill up that we can mill any particular variety. And there's a reason for that. I'm a miller. I am not a farmer. You're the farmer. You know what suits your farm best in terms of whether it's east-facing, south-facing, whether it drains fast, slow, whatever else. And when I came here just under 30 years ago, that was borne out to me very, very succinctly. There were two farms either side of a valley, very close to here. They were both growing exactly the same oats from exactly the same batch of seed. And one grew exceedingly well and one grew horrifically badly. Mm. And I was asked to explain why. And it became very obvious to me very, very early on in my career in this industry that the farmer knows his farm much better than we do. So we allow them to grow what is best for them. We then mill it.
When you get the oats, is there obviously quality control? Is there kind of testing that's done, or how do you assess the quality of it?
Yes, we have a specification that goes behind everything we buy. And that specification has a number of parameters to them. There is things that are big no-nos, so infestation or taint, which would be things like if it's gone through a dryer and it's got diesel through, etc. Those are complete big crosses, does not move, sorry, it would go back to where from whence it came. Mm-hmm. Then there is the other side, which are things like bushel weight, screenings, moisture, etc. Now, these are things that we have specifications, so it's got to be above a certain amount or below a certain amount. If it doesn't quite match into that, we obviously want to work with the farmers. So we will do something here to make it better. By that, I mean, if you take a ton of oats in and let's say 50% of it you normally get, so you get half a ton out. If there's a huge amount of screenings in there, then obviously we will not get 50%. So there'll be a monetary consideration that will be agreed between either the farmer, the merchant, ourselves, and then we can take that amount, that product in, and we can mill what's left. If it gets below, there is a sort of our specification level, then there's another level we can work to below that, then it becomes impossible to mill these sort of things. But we can play with a number of parameters, and those parameters will be the moisture, the bushel weight, and the screenings, and then we'll take the product in here.
And what's the bushel weight?
Bushel weight is basically, the best way to describe the bushel weight is how big and bold the oat is.
Okay.
So you put it into a particular size of a diameter of a tube and then find the weight that's in that tube and you get a very, very quick answer to whether the oat is big and bold or whether it's got very, very small, needly oats. We have a problem milling small, needly oats. We would love milling big, bold oats because those are the best for a milling process.
And does that depend on the variety or the growing conditions?
It depends on lots of things, one of which is variety, one of which is growing conditions, one of which is when it's been put in the fields, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Okay. Gosh, so many different factors to consider.
Yes.
So how then are the oats processed? I know there's different types of oat products that you see in the supermarket. There's groats and pinhead or flaked? What is the difference?
Flakes and meals and all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, an oat is one of the better cereals insofar as it has a husk round about it, which we call an outer coating. And that protects the oat. So if there's bad weather at harvest time or around harvest time, oats don't tend to have as big a problem as other cereals because they've got this husk. So that protects them. So the oat comes in with this husk on it. There's two things we need, or three things we need to do. One is we need to clean the oats. So we need to get rid of all the bits and pieces that come with the oats that we don't want. It's a farming product. It comes from the farm. It will have inclusions in it. It will have the odd dead something in it. It will have a bit of straw. It will have dust. It will have all sorts of other things. So we've got to get rid of all of that to start with. We're then left with the oat, which has got this husk round about it. We need to remove that husk to get to the middle bit, which we call a groat. That middle bit, once you've separated the husk and you've got this middle bit, that's the start of everything else we make. But there's one problem with that. Left to its own devices, that would go rancid over a period of time. So you have to kiln it. And you kiln it by putting it through a kiln, which has, the best way of describing it is steam radiators, like the old school radiators you would get if you're that old and remember the old school radiators, big metal things. So you stick that into a big box, put it through, and it takes, in our case, 3.5-4 hours to go through that box. And at the end of it, it's the enzymes are killed, which means that you now have a shelf life. And we put between 12 and 18 months shelf life on that product. So it gives you a shelf life. It gives you a stark product for everything you make. I'll very, very quickly tell you what products we make and how we make it.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to make jumbo groats, which are those that you would see in the muesli flakes, etc., you would take one of these groats and you would squash it. If you want to make porridge oat flakes, you would take one of those groats, not the same one, but one of those groats, you would cut it into a couple of pieces and you would squash them. If you want to make oatmeal, you would take the same groat and you would grind it down, depending on whether you wanted coarse oatmeal, a medium, a fine, or whatever. And if you wanted, that groat also has two particles to it. On the outer edge is where the oat bran is. On the inner edge is where the oat flour is. You can separate those and you end up with oat bran and oat flour. And those are the range of products that we produce.
Thanks so much for that explanation.
Was that succinct enough?
And of course, nutritionally, they are very, very good to include in the diet. I always say to my clients to include more of.
Absolutely.
Nutritionally, they're a source of folate, zinc, iron, potassium. They're high in thiamine, phosphorus, copper, magnesium, all these amazing essential nutrients. And of course, I think that the main one is they're high in fiber, which I'm sure you know about yourself, but especially the soluble fiber, which is beta-glucan,
yes,
which forms about half of their fiber content, is this beta-glucan, yes, which can really help reduce cholesterol and blood sugar levels and helps promote healthy gut microbiome as well, and also increases feeling of fullness, that satisfaction you get, so can help with weight management as well. We all definitely need to eat more fiber. In Scotland, I think it's fewer than 10% of adults meet the 30 grams a day fiber intake that's recommended.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, so it's ticked all the boxes, so what's not to like?
Exactly.
I call it the sexy breakfast cereal, which 20 years ago people used to look at you surprisingly, but now people are beginning to understand it. When I first came here, our sales were very much towards the winter period. And the reason was because people ate porridge when it got cold.
Yeah.
It was winter. In the summer, they didn't. And then in the last sort of 10 to 20 years, there's been a real push on salts and sugars being bad for you and other things being good for you. And oats and porridge tick all those boxes and tick them very big, with very big ticks. So we have seen sales rise. But the other thing we've seen is that instead of being a huge drop in the summer, we've seen a flattening out. It's still, there is more eaten in the winter, but there's definitely a flattening out of sales throughout the year. So it's more a year-round phenomenon. And it's because it's a sexy breakfast cereal. It doesn't have added sugars and salts. What we put in is what we get out. So it's natural and it ticks all the boxes as you've described. Yes, it's good for you.
So can we talk about porridge then?
Yes.
You're obviously an expert in this area. So what is the secret of making a good porridge, would you say?
I was hoping you were not going to ask me that question. The secret of getting a good porridge is having a good wife who can make good porridge in the morning. No, that's probably a very sexist comment, but my wife makes the best porridge. I'm okay at it, but she's brilliant at it. And I like larger flakes, and I like oats and bran, which is added wheat bran to it, which you can buy as part of the product range. And why do I like that? It just suits my taste. But she's brilliant at getting up in the morning, putting an amount of porridge in the pot, and with an amount of, I have 50% milk, 50% water we have, just to give us that creaminess to it. Mm-hmm. And then she stirs it a few times, walks away, comes back about 15 minutes later, and hey, presto, the porridge is ready. I've either burnt it or I've got to sit over the top of it. And then we add fresh strawberries and raspberries, especially in season, and I just can't beat it. Absolutely wonderful.
Sounds delicious. I tend to make mine in the microwave.
Is
that controversial?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. There's something nice about getting porridge made in a pot. I don't know what it is. There is definitely a slightly different taste. It's faster in the microwave, and I do it myself, you know, when I'm really rushed. But no, sitting in a pot, as I say, she can walk away and do it. I've got to sit on top of it, otherwise it burns.
And when you make it in the pot, you use a different type of oat product. Is that rolled oats?
You can use anything in any place.
Okay.
One of the things that's happened in the last sort of 10, 15 years is that the porridge marketplace has moved from what I'd call a traditional porridge eater, who's the person who would buy a 1 kilo bag and use it daily in their house, through to a whole different set of customers. So at one end, you'll get those going to the office in the morning. So they've obviously trying to tick the box in terms of eating something that's healthy, so they don't want to go into a Starbucks or whatever and get a pasty or a pasty with their coffee. So they'll take a pot of porridge, and in that pot will be porridge plus usually a flavour and usually some sugar in it. And then they'll add hot water, mix it up. 2 minutes later, hey presto, they've got it. Then you'll get those who use it in their family, but it's maybe only one that will use porridge. Somebody else will have Kellogg's cornflakes or whatever else. So that's where sachets came about. So you could have one sachet which was pre-made in terms of the quantities, pop it into either a microwave bowl or into the pot and mix it up and away you go. So you have a number of different people using porridge that were never the case 20, 30 years ago. It was only pure packets of porridge. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the good canny Scotsman will always buy a 1 kilo bag because that's the cheapest way to buy it. But if you're in the middle of London and you're going to the office in the morning, then you'll buy a pot of porridge. So it's quite interesting. It's gone across a huge array of different people. Different people eat it in different ways. Mm-hmm. As long as you eat it, I have no complaints.
Yeah. And it does actually tend to taste better if you do make it in a pan and over a,
yeah,
or soak it overnight, yeah, and then warm it in the morning.
I'm not a great soaker overnight person.
Okay.
But I've tried it. I've just not, we've just got used to, I think I'm old and senile, I suspect, in that respect. I've got used to going up, getting up in the morning, putting it in the pot, making it, and then when it's lovely, piping hot, putting on your raspberries and strawberries, and hey presto,
yeah,
can't complain.
Part of the morning routine.
It is, yeah. Trying to wake up in the morning.
And what, I'm not sure if this is another controversial question, but bros or porridge?
Oh, right. Oh, it's going to be another interesting one.
What would you prefer?
Well, I like porridge. It's quite interesting because bros effectively is oatmeal with liquid. And it comes back a way back in the old days to when people were poorer. People had oats in a number of different forms throughout the day. So 20 years ago, we had an old engineer who was on site here, and he remembers the days. So he's not that long dead now. So I'm thinking early 1900s, 1920s, something like that. He remembers the days in the morning, he'd get up and his mum would have a massive big pan of porridge, and she would make it and you'd have your porridge in the morning. And the rest, you pulled out a drawer, filled the bottom with greaseproof paper, and poured your porridge in. You wait until it's set, you then cut it into bits, and that was, you were given that in the morning to take into the fields. And that was your break in the morning. Now, that is a forerunner of what we've now got today is muesli bars. Uh-huh. So in those days, and even prior to that probably, they would take an amount of oatmeal. Now, remembering that oatmeal is eaten much more in the north of Scotland than it would be in, say, in the south of England. In fact, if you went to somewhere around about London and used the word oatmeal, they'd look at you as if you've grown two horns. They have no idea what it is. Oatmeal is a traditional north product because that's what you used to make in the old mills. You used to grind down oats and made it into meal. You couldn't make porridge way back 100 years ago. Just physically, it was impossible. It was a new phenomenon of porridge flakes. So you put a little bit of oatmeal, you would take your liquid, and you would either put it into a container that had the liquid and the meal in it, and you would shake it around as you went around during the day. And at the end of the, when you stopped to have some material for your break or your lunch, then your brose would be ready. Or else you take your dry oatmeal, either eat it dry or stick it into a pot with some liquid, mix it up, very, very quick porridge, which effectively was your brose. So that's what brose is. It's like oatmeal porridge. It's the forerunner of today's oatmeal porridge. So what you've got, if you look at our Hamlin's brand, we've got oat flakes and we've got oatmeals in there, because the further north you go, the more people who eat oatmeal. Further south you go, the more people who eat oat flakes, because it's less traditional, but it's faster and it's quicker. And that's where oat flakes came about. They came about because they wanted something that was faster, quicker, and easier to prepare.
Okay. So brose was the kind of original way.
It was original, yes. So I'm came from the Central Belt, unfortunately. So I was born and brought up on porridge flakes. So hence, that's why I like porridge made from flakes.
And I remember my granddad having brose every morning, and there was a particular kind of ritual almost.
Oh, did he spirit? Did he invoke the devil, or did he spirit the correct way?
I have no idea, but he had it in a wooden bowl,
yep.
Very particular, and the spirtle used to stir it.
Yes. Well, if you stir it the wrong way, and I'm not going to tell you which is the right and the wrong way, but if you stir it the wrong way, you invoke the devil, it is said. So you've got to stir it the correct way using a spirtle. And a spirtle basically is a round bit of wood. And I suspect, and I don't know this for certain, but I suspect that's because way back hundreds of years ago, that's what you had. If you were making something to stir, you got a bit of wood, you shaved it down, and that was your original stirring piece. So from that came the porridge spirtle, and you get some lovely carved porridge spirtles. I've got slightly different designs on them and shapes, etc. But effectively, they're a round bit of wood, and they allow the porridge, if you were to stir a porridge with a spirtle or stir a porridge with a wooden spoon, it is a different texture at the end of it. Mm. Don't ask me why. That was your next question. Please don't ask me why.
I'll have to experiment with that then.
Absolutely.
But no, I remember him doing that and saying the Selkirk grace at the same time.
Yeah. But did he have it? Did he have his milk beside it, or did he have his milk on the top?
I think it was with water that he had it with, and a bit of salt, which as a nutritionist I would probably not recommend.
But, but you wouldn't recommend sugar either. So,
well, no. A few fresh berries if there is, but natural sugars. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about is the World Porridge Making Championship, which sounds very exciting. Now, this is something that I know Hamlin's has been supporting for quite a few years, but can you explain what the championship is, first of all, and how it came about?
It started, as I say, I've been here nearly 30 years, so it must have started close to 30 years back. And it started because the village of Carbridge wanted something to promote itself on the UK and international stage. They thought they were being left behind a bit. They wanted to promote themselves, and they came up with the idea of having the World Porridge Making Championships, because there was no such thing. As we were the mill in the northeast of Scotland, very close to, or relatively close to Carbridge, they approached us, and I thought it was a great idea. But I thought it was a great idea on one proviso, that we didn't run it, because it would then become the Hamlin's World Porridge Making Championships, not the Carbridge. And it was being done by the local people of Carbridge to promote Carbridge and to obviously promote porridge. So we sponsor it. We have done since day one. The local people run it, and it is their World Porridge Making Championships. You can imagine if a marketing team got hold of it, it'd suddenly become the Hamlin's World Porridge Making Championship, be dragged off to Edinburgh, Glasgow, whatever else. And it fits perfectly with Carbridge. It's a wonderful idea. They get behind it. They promote it. So it's a local thing. If you've been to Carbridge, you'll know Carbridge is not a big place. Mm-hmm. It's a small place. It's got a very active set of people who promote various things in the village. It's surrounded by some bigger places like Aviemore, which tends to get all the promotion, etc. So they have things that are interesting and different. One is the World Porridge Making Championships. It's gone from being a Scottish thing to a UK thing to half the people come from around the world, and they come back again to try and win it. Mm. There's two categories. One is the traditional, and you're only allowed to use three ingredients in the traditional, but when you get to the speciality, well, that's when people have some weird and wonderful and interesting things. Fish with porridge, you know, things that you might not think about to start with. So there's two categories, and someone is crowned every year World Porridge Champion. Sometimes it's Scottish, sometimes it's Swedish, sometimes it can be other countries. It just depends on who wins on the day.
I was seeing, yeah, there are entrants from all over the world, like you were saying, from as far as afield as Australia, Zimbabwe, USA, Ukraine.
Sweden, yes, absolutely, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's great. It has brilliant PR because it is so different, interesting, and because it's a lovely part of the world. So the whole thing goes together. A natural product from a lovely part of the world, sponsoring an event in a lovely part of the world. So the whole thing just ticks the box. And they got great PR out of it.
Yeah. And have you learned a thing or two then about the techniques or the different flavors?
I would never compete. Can you imagine losing? You imagine being last in the group? No, I would never compete.
Couldn't show your face in the office again.
You've never seen my culinary skills if you think I was going to compete. No, not at all.
But there are some weird and wacky flavors. I was looking at the website, and certainly on your website and the Hamlin's website, you've got a range of recipes which look fantastic. Just shows off the versatility of oats. There was one, I think, carrot and turmeric porridge recipe, which sounded quite nice. I've not tried that before.
Well, there is the traditional recipes which cater for those who are looking for something that mum might eat or whatever. And then there is some recipes that we either get sent in or we develop with individual chefs throughout the years. We put it on our website, and yes, it can get into some weird and wonderful places. As I say, fish and porridge, scallops and porridge, you know, once you get into that, you're beginning to get adventurous, I would suggest.
Yeah, I've never really thought of putting fish in my porridge, but
it's happened and it's tried, and yes, you'd be surprised, some of them are absolutely wonderful.
Okay,
I get to try some of them, and some of them maybe not quite as interesting as others.
Not so much. Okay, good experimenting.
Mm.
And of course, it is coming up quite soon. So it's the 7th of October.
It is, yes.
So get yourself to Carrbridge. It's a wonderful place to visit.
Absolutely. And they make a big thing of it. You know, they've got a procession and it's judged by some exciting judges. And yes, it's a small place. You can only take a small number of competitors. So, you know, it's an exciting and interesting event. Yes, absolutely.
I'll look out for that. And obviously, it's not just porridge, as I mentioned before, it is a versatile ingredient. So have you seen, you know, an increase in the different types of products? I know, like, I never used to have overnight oats, and now that's I've converted from porridge to overnight oats over the summer months, especially.
Yep.
But yeah, there must have been it feels like there's been a huge increase in the different types of products that oats are now used in.
When I first came here, let's just say about 30 years ago, we were selling a lot of porridge in packets, in these 1 kilo packets. We would sell to industrial companies who would then make it into other things. And they'd be fairly traditional, oat cakes, haggises, that type of thing. Over the years, what's happened, the porridge market has, as I explained earlier, has gone into different directions. So you've got the pots, the sachets. Obviously, the meals were always there. That was very traditional. But then you've started to get people who wanted special products, slightly different thicknesses or tastes or textures or whatever. But the biggest change has been in the industrial side. So if you've gone into a supermarket 25, 30 years ago and looked to see where oats were in, they were in the traditional range of products. So you would get oat cakes, you would get the haggises, black puddings, etc. Very little else. Now, if you go down and have a look at the ingredients in a lot of products, you'll get oats in all sorts of products. And the reason is what we talked about way back earlier. It's because it's nutritionally good for you. It's healthy. It ticks lots of boxes. So people who are developing products over that piece, and we've worked with a lot of companies, have been trying to include oats in all sorts of different forms. So it might be that they want an oat in there, but they don't want the traditional oat texture or taste. So they might go for an oat flour, which has a very, very glutinous feel to it. So that might be a filler in certain things, but it's oats. So therefore, it helps the nutrition of that particular product. So now you get all sorts of products, biscuits, cakes, desserts, all sorts of things have oats in it that you never saw before. You get chocolate bars with oats in it now. I never thought we'd see chocolate with oats in it, but great, absolutely wonderful. So you begin to see it across the whole gambit of things, and it's purely because people are trying to make things healthier.
Yeah, and yeah, there seems to be a huge amount of innovation in terms of how oats can be used in different muffins and biscuits and breads, etc.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Now, you can't make a bread completely out of oats. That's impossible. You don't have the rise that you would have out of wheat flour or some other flours. So you can't make 100% oat bread. Or you can, but it'd be very, very stodgy, very, very small in height. But you can use it as a percentage, and people can play with that percentage. It depends on what else you put in it and depends on which part of the oat, etc. I suppose the biggest thing recently has been the increase in oat milks and all sorts of other non-dairy milks. So oat milk has become the biggest milk, and you'll see huge amounts of oat milks in the cabinets now. And that oat milk then goes in and is used in other products. So we're talking about people using different types of oats into their mixtures when they're developing. Now they're using oat milks in their development. And again, it's for that reason of health and nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, yeah, it adds a healthiness to lots of foods then.
Yes, it does.
And can I ask, just to finish off, how do you most prefer to eat your oats? Is it porridge, or do you have a particular favourite oaty food of all the possible foods?
I love porridge, as I said. But the one thing I do love is fresh new tatties, just boiled into the oven, or even with the skins on in the oven, and then a little bit of butter over the top and oats put over the top of that, just sprinkled over the top. Oats with new tatties, absolutely wonderful.
Ooh, like a little crumble topping.
Well, yes.
Or just a crust.
Slightly less than that, yeah. But it just gives a slight difference to lovely new tatties.
Oh, I don't think I've tried that before. That does sound delicious.
That's where I like my oats.
Thanks for the top tip there. Well, thank you so much for all your insight and helping clarify what the different types of oats are and how they're processed and how they're grown.
No problem. I hope you've learned something.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been fascinating, and I will appreciate my porridge even more.
Good. Excellent.
Thanks for listening to this Food Connections podcast. Do check out the show notes for some useful links related to this episode. There's more details about the Golden Spurtle World Porridge Making Championship in Carr Bridge, and check out the recipe pages on Hamlin's website. There's a huge selection of all types of meals, snacks and drinks to make with oats. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could give it a rating and leave a wee review, and please do spread the word and tell others about it. If you have any comments or suggestions for future guests, do get in touch. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.